Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to the program. My guest today is Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Between 1983 and 1998, Bruce was the state coordinator of the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice and has worked on space issues for 27 years. Incidentally, he used to be a Republican and a member of the US Air Force. In 2006, he was the recipient of the Dr. Benjamin Spock Peacemaker Award, and in 2010, Bruce was extensively featured in the award-winning documentary called Pax Americana and the Weaponization of Space. He's a member of the National Writers Union. His articles have appeared in many publications, and he writes a popular blog called Organizing Notes. Bruce initiated the main campaign to bring our war dollars home in 2009 that spread to other New England states and beyond. This campaign made the important connections between endless war spending and fiscal crisis throughout the US. We spoke to Bruce Gagnon about a year ago, and he joins us again now. Bruce, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Hello, Helen. Great to be with you again.
Yeah. Why don't you just remind the audience, Bruce, about your origins when you were young and Republican parties and stuff?
Well, I grew up in the Air Force, in an Air Force family. So we moved all around as I grew up, living behind the barbed wire fences. Very Republican, conservative, military family, as you can imagine. And then in 1968, we were living in the panhandle of Florida, so conservative there, they call it Lower Alabama. And I was the vice chair of the Okaloosa County, Florida Young Republican Club. And actually did such a good job working on that campaign that right before the election, they had a fundraiser for Nixon, and they asked me to sit at the head table with their guest speaker that evening, someone I know you've heard of. He died a few years ago, Senator Strom Thurmond from South Carolina.
Sure do, yep.
So that's kind of how I got my start. And then in January of 1971, I tried to join the Air Force. I wanted to be like my father, a career man, but actually flunked my induction physical. So when most people were trying to stay out of the military because of the war in Vietnam, I had to get a waiver to get in. And after my training, I was sent to one of the key military airlift bases for the war in Vietnam, Travis Air Force Base in California. And at this base, there was lots of anti-war activity outside the gate and also inside the barracks. And as it turned out, my first roommate was one of the leading organizers in the GI resistance movement in the barracks. So lucky me, sitting in the corner at night, several nights a week when there would be meetings of white GIs talking about the war or black GIs talking about racism across America, and me, the young Republican for Nixon, sitting in the corner thinking, oh my God, you know, what have I gotten into? But those people changed my life. And in addition, it was those dozen people outside the gate virtually every single weekend during the war, very loyal, dedicated protesters, very faithfully holding their signs, probably wondering, does it do any good? Do you think anyone's listening? Well, they had us talking for hour upon hour and day after day in the barracks because of their small protest outside our gate. So that's why I'm a big believer in doing actions at bases and military installations, because you create an energy and set a dynamic in motion that essentially birthed me, the peace activist.
Well, that's fascinating, Bruce. Well, did you and your family, you know, when you were young, live in other countries, or was it all in the U.S.?
Yeah, we lived 3 years in England and 3 years in Germany. So, and in my early years, my formative years. So I believe that those experiences, and for whatever reason, my father liked to live off base. He liked to live in the neighborhoods of the Germans and the English. So I grew up around these other cultures in a very intense way. And I think when I came back to the United States and in later years, you know, heard people talking about we're number one, we're better than the rest of the world, everything else, I could never relate to it because I learned early on that people were essentially the same everywhere. They loved their children. They loved to share food. They loved to laugh. They were concerned about the future. And this idea that somehow Americans were different from everyone else, I just could never go along with it.
Yeah, I wonder where that attitude was derived, Bruce. Why do Americans think they're the greatest country on earth?
Well, I think there was a clear program, a clear brainwashing program in this country about American exceptionalism. That it was clearly, you know, coming after World War II, as we entered the Cold War, there was this idea that the American people had to really be brought on board this endless military spending that would really define the Cold War. Mm. And so I think that had a lot to do with it, that we were out there to secure democracy around the world because we were the exceptional nation. We were God's chosen people.
Oh, yeah. Well, now you've just been in a big demonstration, we'd say in Australia, a demo, outside the White House on December the 16th. What were you protesting about? How many people were there? What reception did you get? What was the weather like? And who amongst those people was quite famous?
Well, it was a protest organized by Veterans for Peace, which I belong to and have for many years now. It was a call put out just a couple months ago to have veterans come to the White House gate, to the White House fence, and be arrested in an act of nonviolent civil disobedience opposing these endless wars. And there were several hundred people at the protest on a very cold and snowy day, and then 131 were arrested at the fence, including myself. The notables that were there were the journalist, the award-winning journalist Chris Hedges, who was arrested for his very first time. Mm. Also former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who people should be familiar with, who briefed Daddy Bush when he was president of the United States. Daniel Ellsberg, of course, from the Pentagon Papers fame, who, you know, I also attribute to helping turn me into a peace activist because it was the release of the Pentagon Papers in the early 70s that I then read while I was in the military. In fact, I got in trouble for reading it at my desk in my office and refusing to stop. I would give sort of mini lectures on it to the other people where I worked, trying to show them how America had lied its way into the Vietnam War, just as we've more recently lied our way into Afghanistan and Iraq and now Pakistan. So he was there, and I was also arrested. And in fact, the looks on the three of those guys' faces were just treasures because you could just see they felt liberated. You know, they felt liberated to be there together, to be with all these veterans, old and young. There were many veterans from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars that were there with us and got arrested with us. And it was just a really remarkable experience. So tremendous, tremendous event. And, you know, we're spending more than $8 billion every month on this endless war in Afghanistan. And as Chris Hedges so rightly says, all the doors of reform have been locked. Essentially, democracy has been drowned in America as the corporations have taken control of the Congress and the White House. And so there is very little left. And in fact, in a series of weekly columns in the month before the protest, Chris Hedges was laying out over and over again this question, talking about hope. Where do we get hope? Because he's often criticized by some people for putting out a dark view of politics today as we head towards feudalism and fascism. And he said very clearly in his speech that day on December 16th at the White House and before in his writings that hope comes from standing in resistance when they're drowning our democracy. And so I believe it's true. Those that want hope and those that want to help create hope have to look towards a nonviolent resistance if we hope to be able to make any changes whatsoever. The people have to essentially stand in rebellion, or as I like to say, it's time to rattle our chains.
Yeah, that reminds me of a very famous American historian, Harold Lasswell, who wrote in the 19th century, "If they lose their chains of iron, beware of the chains of silver," meaning that if corporations and the like and the powers that be couldn't really have slave labor and control the people physically in that way, they'd control them through propaganda methods and through enormous wealth. And it's exactly what's happened. And Bruce, how do you prognosticate the next 2 years of Congress, where the Republicans are going to do everything they can to destroy Obama? Any legislation that's up, they're going to vote against. Tea Partiers in there doing their thing, trying to destroy the healthcare bill, trying to destroy unions. In fact, you know, working actively against the average American person. How do you think that's going to play out?
Well, you know, when you're on a roll, it's like gambling, you know. When you're on a roll, you're going to keep going.
Mm.
And right now, the Republicans are winning, even when today the Democrats control the Senate, they control the House, they obviously control the White House, and the Republicans are still winning. And so why won't the Republicans continue to roll the dice as long as they're winning, as long as the Democrats and President Obama are essentially capitulating over and over and over again on virtually every issue? Maybe not every single issue, but virtually every issue, particularly the important ones, the most important ones, economics and foreign policy. When it comes to economics, bank bailouts, tax cuts for the rich, continuation of war, continuation of massive military spending, cutting back on civil liberties, continuing the Guantanamo and the death camps that they have in Afghanistan, where people are being killed by torture, continuing today. The Republicans are getting virtually everything they want. So why won't they continue to roll the dice? And when will anyone stand up to stop them? When will the Democrats, the Democrats are allowing Obama to do things that they would never have let Bush do. Massive tax cuts for the rich continuing. If Bush was in office today, the Democrat Congress would never have gone along with that. So,
well, why do you think, Bruce, that the Democrats have been so lily-livered in the face of the Republican onslaught? Why haven't they had the guts to stand up and speak the truth, especially when they had the majority in the House, Senate, and the White House?
Well, I think it's a fundamentally important question. I would refer people to, again, Chris Hedges' new book, Death of the Liberal Class, where he really lays out, I think, a very strong argument that the liberal class essentially is part of the ruling corporate class. And they have historically, if we look back to the time of Woodrow Wilson, for example, and World War One, when Wilson was the one who threw Emma Goldman and many other anti-war people out of the country, just for passing around leaflets telling people not to sign up for the draft during World War One, or, you know, as it began. It was Woodrow Wilson's administration that threw Eugene Debs in prison for making a speech in Canton, Ohio at a rally where he called people to not go to war for the rich people, you know, a war that would benefit the rich. So it was a quote-unquote liberal Democrat that did all those things during that time. And we're seeing that similar kind of weak politics coming out of the Democratic Party today.
So they're really all part of the establishment. That's really what you're saying.
Yeah, I think so. It's obvious.
And they've got Obama where they want him. But what I wanted to really ask you is, after 2 years of Republican rule and cutting benefits here, there and everywhere and destroying the middle class and the poor increasing in numbers, when will Mr. and Mrs. Joe Sixpack rise up and say, that's enough, for Christ's sake, we, you know, how dare you? Or will they be so propagandized through Fox, et cetera, by watching that absolute garbage every day, will they not know what they need to do and they won't rise up and they'll be, in effect, anesthetized?
Well, I think that's the challenge for us, in what we call the progressive community or on the left. I live in a working-class town in Bath, Maine, and I can tell you the people here are really hurting bad.
Are they?
Really badly.
In what way? Describe.
Unemployment is growing dramatically. People are working 2 and 3 and 4 part-time jobs.
Oh, my God.
They're getting no health care. There's a, actually right at this very moment, one of the local churches has a weekly, they call it the Neighborhood Cafe, and 300 people are expected to be fed there tonight as they come and at the food pantry to get food. And so you're just seeing the numbers grow and grow and grow at each of these weekly feeding programs that happen at this little church just down the street from where I live. Our roads are falling apart. The bridges are falling apart. The bridge between Maine and New Hampshire is now under such terrible repair that they're worried that it's going to collapse, and there's not very much money in either of our state governments to fix them. So, it's just a crisis situation, and education is being slashed in our state dramatically. Mm. Teachers are being laid off. Schools are closing around the state. Libraries are cutting back on hours, public libraries. You know, it's just a whole slate of issues.
So,
and people, people are afraid. People are afraid to speak out. And that really opens the door for those on the right wing, what I call bullies, essentially, to keep barging around and making people afraid.
Well, what's the fear that they have? What are they frightened of?
Like teachers, for example. Oh. Teachers are afraid to speak out because if they do, they're afraid they'll get laid off next. And
no.
People that work for social programs, they're afraid to speak out because if they do, then their program that gets funded by state or local government or United Way funding will be defunded. And so there's this job scaredness out there that is really freezing a lot of people. So at a time... In order to answer your earlier question, though, what are we going to do in the next 2 years? Are we going to be able to block this, Tea Party machine from rolling over us like a steamroller? Well, the question is, are we going to be able to get people who know better and who see what's going on to find? Are we going to help them find the courage to stand up and speak out, not only for themselves but for the society as a whole? And that's really the open question. That's the academic question of our time. And right now, it's tough organizing. I will say that peace groups around the country are beginning. They're just beginning to really begin to make these connections. That's why we started this Bring Our War Dollars Home campaign that has been really successful in Maine. We got both of our two members of Congress just last week to vote against the Pentagon Appropriations Committee for 2011. They both voted no on it. There were only 48 in the House that voted no. It passed overwhelmingly. But our two members of Congress voted no. They didn't want to, but they did because we've done a really good job with the Bring Our War Dollars Home campaign. It's now spreading to some other states. So some people are beginning to, in the peace movement, are beginning to make the connection between endless war and the economic collapse at home. We can't just keep talking about bring the troops home. We've got to start talking about the issue that most people are worried about, and that's jobs and money. And if we connect those to the war and continually talk about the cost of war and stay on message with that, I think we can begin to impact Mr. and Mrs. Average out there. But if we don't, if we stay pure and just keep saying, bring the troops home, war is not the answer.
No one will listen.
No, and they're not going to listen. It's old news.
My guest today is Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. So, Bruce, in fact, where you live in Bath, the military dollars are coming home because that's where they build the Aegis ships, which will launch missile defense, right? Isn't that a huge shipbuilding area?
That's right. The Navy Aegis destroyers that are being outfitted with so-called missile defense systems, what we like to call missile offense systems, because they're really part of U.S. first strike strategy. They're today being deployed by Obama surrounding China and now increasingly surrounding Russia. And Obama has decided to put these ships in the Baltic Sea, if you can imagine. Russia's freaking out. It's one of Russia's concerns about this new START treaty, saying if you go forward with missile defense system deployments surrounding us the way you're planning to do, both on land and sea, then we might pull out of this START treaty. So Obama just in the last days has reassured the right wing in America that he's going to go forward with missile defense systems, even if that means that Russia pulls out of the START treaty. So Obama's
He's got no guts, has he?
No. And you know, I've got to say that I'm not so sure that he ever had any, and that I'm not so sure that a lot of people that thought he was going to be something different weren't really misreading the tea leaves. It was fairly obvious to me all along.
Really, Bruce? Why? How was it so obvious during the election campaign?
Well, I've got a friend, and he's an older man in his 80s here in town. He's a Jewish man. He told me a couple months before the election, he said, Bruce, you ever heard of the Crown family from Chicago? I said, no. He said, go home and Google them, C-R-O-W-N-E. And I did, and I found out that they were the major stockholders in General Dynamics that builds the Aegis destroyers at Bath Iron Works here in Maine. And it was the Crown family that helped create Obama as a national candidate. They raised money for him across the nation within the Jewish community. They obviously helped open doors to the military-industrial complex because they were majority owners of General Dynamics Weapons Corporation. And so they promoted him early on when he was a nobody, when nobody really knew anything about him. They helped create his national funding base early on. And we know that, and it was reported in the in Space News, industry publications that I subscribe to, that Obama was getting more campaign donations and got more than John McCain did during the entire campaign from the military-industrial complex. So they saw him as someone that they could count on. In fact, right after the election, after Obama won the election, and one of the first issues of Space News that came out immediately afterwards, they said, don't worry, everybody, relax. It's going to be fine. He's going to give us everything we want. And so it was obvious to me that Obama was a brand sold to the people, used great rhetoric, great speaker, you know, great progressive language and everything else. But I've been through that scene before now. I've grown to be a little bit leery of it, and I didn't fall for it this time.
Well, Bruce Gagnon, why do you think Obama wanted to be president personally?
Well, you know, I mean, this is just a subjective answer, but, you know, I think he was an ambitious guy. One other thing that I read before the election was a interview with Zbigniew Brzezinski. Remember, he was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. And he identified Obama early on when Obama was a student at Columbia University, where Brzezinski was teaching. And you have to remember that I heard Dr. Manning Marable, the great black sociologist, political scientist, historian, talk about some years ago, it's been 15, 20 years ago, and I heard him in a workshop say that, you know, when you look at the demographics in America in the next 50 years, he said, blacks and Hispanics are going to be the majority population in America. And so clearly the oligarchy in the United States is looking ahead, and they understand that they have to come up with some people of color candidates that will still be committed to them that they will control, but that will get out in front of the parade and lead the people, making them feel like that they're being listened to, that finally we get a black person to be president, all that kind of thing. So I think that's what has happened in this case. I think Obama was selected. And back to my story about Zbigniew Brzezinski, in this interview in a British publication, again, I read before the election, he said, I vetted Obama early on, and I'm very confident, you know, he's going to be just fine. And, you know, he was clearly sending a message.
Yeah, but I still don't understand. We were so excited. Everyone was all over the world. He seemed to be so altruistic. He called for the abolition of nuclear weapons in Prague, you know, and it's hard for me to accept that cynical view, except the more and more as stuff comes out and he's exposed, the more I have to say, well, I guess that's the case. I mean, it just destroys my faith in humanity in a way.
Are you familiar with the award-winning investigative journalist and documentary filmmaker John Pilger?
Of course, he's Australian. I know okay. John. Yep.
So you know him. Well, I heard him in an interview 6-9 months ago talking about Obama, talking about this very question that you and I are discussing right now.
Yes.
And he said, you know, Obama in his biography has this kind of missing ear. And he said, all it says is that he went to work for Business International Corporation. But he didn't talk about anything else in his, you know, in his biography, you know, and nobody really knows much else about that year. It's just kind of missing year. And Pilger says, I know Business International Corporation. I know who they are. They're a long-time CIA front group.
Oh.
And so some people believe that, again, if you subscribe to this theory that since the assassination of John Kennedy, the oligarchy hasn't taken any chances, and they've made sure that they essentially run two horses in every race, and that they control ultimately all the candidates, and that in this case, that Obama, again, was vetted early on and developed early on as a candidate for the oligarchy. If you think about it, George W. Bush was president and the pot on the stove was boiling. The steam was getting too high. The American people and people all over the world were raging over the cowboy, the bad cowboy, George W. Bush. And so they had to turn the steam down. So they bring in the good cowboy, Barack Obama. And he continues essentially on the big stuff. Mm. He continues the empire building. He continues the wars. He continues the military spending. He continues the missile defense and Star Wars developments. He continues the corporate welfare that is going on today, the tax cuts for the very wealthy. Oh, yes, he on some of the social issues, for example, don't ask, don't tell, you know, gay rights, not to in any way marginalize those issues or say they're not important, but they don't have major impact on the rich, the powerful, and the empire. Mm. And so on the social issues, you see the sum of the difference from the Democrats and from Obama. But ultimately on the big stuff that the empire really cares about, there is really very little distinction between Bush and Obama. But most importantly, Barack Obama has been able to demobilize the left. He's been able to completely demobilize the peace movement across America. And this is something George W. Bush could never have done.
He mobilized
John McCain had been elected instead of Obama, the peace movement and much of the left, most of the left, all of the left, would still be organizing and raging today.
Yeah, it makes me feel sick in the stomach, really, as you talk, and I have to admit that's probably... So how many people, you talk about the oligarchy, Bruce Gagnon, how many people do you think in America control the oligarchy? Is it just the people who gather at the Bohemian Grove each year, about 200, do you reckon?
You know, frankly, I don't know the answer to that. I'm sure it's just a handful.
It's a handful because they interdigitate on each other's boards. So if you look
at the
board of GE and Washington Post and all sorts of things, they all sit on the same boards together.
Just for example, when Daddy Bush, George W.'s daddy, Herbert Walker Bush, left the presidency, he went on some of the boards of pharmaceutical corporations.
Yeah.
So, you know, they really, you know, whether it's media, banking, drug industry, weapons corporations, like you say, interlocking boards of directors.
Yep. So what people should know is that, and I'm sure they do, that their tax dollars are now being spent to the tune of $1 trillion or thereabouts on killing. Pentagon and all the associated industries and the like.
Annually. Right.
What it seems to me, Bruce Gagnon, is we need a leader like Joan of Arc or like Bruce of Arc to stand up and inspire and lead the people. But the trouble is, it's very damn difficult to lead the people these days when they're all controlled by sitting in front of their boxes every day, every night, watching this terrible stuff come out of the television, being brainwashed and being anesthetized and not knowing what's going on. How do you get a leader exposure without being on the media? I grapple with that because I had a lot of exposure on the media in the early 80s because I had an agent in Hollywood who worked for me for free and got me on with Lily Tomlin and Sally Field and Candy Bergen and people like that. I don't have that anymore. I don't know how one can engage the people of America, who are damn decent people on the whole, to teach them what's actually happening.
Well, there's one thing you left out when you were talking about people sitting in front of the boxes and, you know, playing their video games or watching television. And this is something you once told me. I don't remember the percent, but you told me X percent of the American people are on antidepressants.
30%.
I've never forgotten that, and it breaks my heart to think about it. And I often talk about it. I often say, you know, Helen Caldicott talks about some high percentage of the American people on antidepressants. And this is a key element in answering your question. Number one, a leader. I don't believe in it. One of my great heroes in history, Eugene Debs, said, you know, a leader can lead you out of a fire, but can lead you right back into one. That's what Barack Obama is doing right now, frankly. We need many leaders.
Mm.
You know, they can shoot one leader, but they can't kill us all. So we need many leaders. And there are many leaders out there.
Mm.
There are many leaders in our communities. Each of us, in our own way, has to become a leader. Each of us is good at something, you know. One of us can write, and another one can do art. You know, we've had a tremendous success here in Maine of getting artists involved in our peace movement now. Early on, when we created the Bring Our War Dollars Home campaign, I went to a group called the Union of Maine Visual Artists, and I asked them, would you become involved with us? Would you help create images of what we could do with this war dollars if we had them back here in Maine? Because we're spending about, since the beginning of the wars in 2001, Maine's share of war spending is $2.9 billion. So, you know, how could we use that money in Maine? And so they brought 70 visual artists, poets together for one whole day last year in this church, and all day long created these images. And then we took them to the state capitol in Augusta because we wanted to get the state government involved in this discussion. We wanted to get local politicians, state politicians, to begin to talk to the federal politicians and say, hey, we're never going to solve our problems, our fiscal problems back here until we cut war spending. And so we've got resolutions going to the towns and cities. Portland City Council, the biggest city in the state, has passed a resolution, Bring Our War Dollars Home. It's now spread to Northampton and Amherst, Massachusetts. They've recently, their city councils have passed it. So, you know, we're doing all those kind of things. But it was these artists that helped us create these images. And now they're working on their third draw-a-thon, as they call it. They've now taken it on themselves to organize. I don't even have to do it. And they're so into it now, and they're doing it in many different towns and cities across the state. It's really wonderful. So we need many leaders, and that's the way we get out from behind it. And as we do this local organizing, I think then we begin to get some of the media that we're trying to get. We're not going to get the national media because they've choked that thing off, okay? We don't have access to it in a real way anymore. But they don't completely control the local media. On election night, I organized Maine Veterans for Peace, which I belong to. We did a 126-mile walk from Farmington, Maine, up north central Maine, to Portland, 126 miles of walking over 9 days, walked through 40 communities, and in every single community we went through, Farmington and Skowhegan and Bangor and Belfast and Bath and Rockland, all the way down the line, we got really major front page stories in each of these newspapers.
Really? That's wonderful.
Veterans walking about the cost of war, one suicide per day of, you know, soldiers, not only ones that have been to fight in the wars, but also soldiers that are afraid to even go or killing themselves, soldiers that haven't even been yet. And so we got tremendous media coverage during this walk. So I think the answer is that we've got to begin to work local more than we have in the past. We've concentrated on Washington a lot in recent years.
It doesn't work.
It's not going to work now. We've got to go to the state and local communities, and they're having everything dumped on them anyway.
Yeah.
So this is where the political action is going to be in the United States.
Well, I think that's wonderful. I'm interviewing Bruce Gagnon, the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. So, Bruce, it occurs to me as you're talking, what we need to do is reinstitute all the New England town meetings, which were in fact responsible for organizing the nuclear weapons freeze. Let me just give you an example. I spoke, I don't know, in 1980 or something in Burlington, Vermont, the University of Vermont, and there was a carpenter in the audience. I love this story. He's still alive. He heard me talk about the threat of nuclear war and annihilation. He then organized all the New England town meetings, which all voted for the nuclear weapons freeze. And I like that analogy because Jesus was a carpenter, of course. And that was very powerful and got the whole thing going. So talking about grassroots, you know, that's a methodology that's always been in place in New England. And is that happening or could you do that, Bruce?
Well, we've been working on that in Maine, and it's passed one town meeting in Deer Isle, Maine. It's passed a school board in Solon, Maine. It's passed the city council of Portland. We've gone to other towns and cities where we were defeated, but we are bringing it to many different communities. And then again, as I said earlier, it's now moving into Massachusetts.
Good.
That has now passed two city council resolutions on this, and people are forcing. It's not just the resolution we're after. We don't really, in a way, care whether we win or lose as much as we'd like to win. Yeah. We want the debate. We want the discussion.
Absolutely.
The consciousness raising, and so that's really beginning to move throughout Maine and throughout the area here.
Well, if you want me to help, I'm coming back in March. You can recruit me for a couple of talks, maybe in New England. Now, I want you to Bruce, talk about the weaponization of space. I want you to do it briefly, clearly, enunciated. Who's behind it and what are they doing right now and intend to do in the future and for what reason?
Well, right now there's been a shift in strategy on the part of the military-industrial complex. They're clearly recognizing that some of their earlier programs weren't working out well. For example, the idea of having a bullet hit a bullet way up in deep space was not working so well.
You mean a missile to hit a missile?
Yes.
Yep.
Exactly. And so Obama, you might remember that Bush had called for deployment of missile interceptors in Poland and a Star Wars radar facility in the Czech Republic. and there was major, major protests in the Czech Republic over this. So soon after Obama came into office, he declared that I'm shutting down this particular Bush program. We're not going to do it. And everybody declared victory and wonderful and everything else. He then made his Prague speech that you referred to earlier, where he said he wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons. And people were feeling good. But then Obama came forward and said, there is a program, missile defense program, that is testing out with much better success. And it's the mid-course and terminal phase system.
Describe that. What is it?
Well, this is the one on the Aegis destroyer, the Navy ship. You might remember China did a anti-satellite weapons test where they blew up one of their old satellites a couple years ago. And right thereafter, the United States, the Pentagon, announced that there was a old military satellite with hydrazine on board, a toxic substance, and it was going to fall back to Earth, and they needed to take it out. And so they used a Aegis destroyer with this, it's called an SM-3 interceptor missile. It's made by Raytheon, and they used it to fire all the way into space to knock out this falling satellite, which, number one, showed that the Aegis destroyer, outfitted with these so-called missile defense systems, was a capable anti-satellite weapon, that they would essentially have the ability to go up and knock out a Chinese satellite or a Russian satellite, as well as hitting missiles. And so this program, this Aegis destroyer program, has been testing out with much greater success. In addition, the Patriot missile that was such a failure during the Persian Gulf War in the 90s is now in its third generation. PAC-3, it's called, Patriot missile, third generation. It's made by Lockheed Martin. Its job is to take out missiles in their terminal phase.
What's the terminal phase? You haven't described terminal or mid-course.
Yeah, mid-course is more up while something is outside of the Earth atmosphere. The Raytheon made a missile onboard these Navy ships is this system that would intercept a missile when it's outside the Earth atmosphere, a little higher up, rather than deep space. Then the terminal phase is as it's descending near its target, just coming back into Earth atmosphere. And the PAC-3, the Patriot third generation, made by Lockheed Martin, its job would be to take those out. And so these two programs today, Obama has said, will be the preferred deployment program. And so today, both the Aegis destroyers, the ships outfitted with these missile defense interceptors, and the PAC-3 ground-based launchers are being deployed by Obama in Taiwan. Can you imagine that? Just off the coast of mainland China, in South Korea, in Japan, in Australia, and on the ground, on land, and then also on these Aegis destroyer Navy ships that are bumping up along the coast of mainland China. At the same time, Obama has said that he's going to deploy these very same systems as NATO is expanding eastward, beginning to surround Russia. Obama has said he's going to deploy these systems in Poland with a new radar system to guide them, in the Czech Republic, just like Bush was going to do. And he's going to put them in Bulgaria and Romania, very possibly Georgia, as the U.S. is trying to bring Georgia into NATO. You remember there was a shooting war between Russia and Georgia just a couple summers ago? The first person to go there after the shooting war ended was, at that point in time, he was a United States Senator, Joseph Biden, went there to pledge the United States' undying loyalty to Georgia. And we've resupplied them since that time with weapons, and we're now trying to bring them into NATO. Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, right on Russia's border, the U.S. is trying to now bring them into NATO. And all these missile defense systems, NATO has just decided just a few months ago at their recent meeting to make a NATO-wide, Europe-wide missile defense program, all centered essentially around surrounding Russia. Why would we do that?
I read that NATO at their last meeting that you've just referred to, Bruce Gagnon, was considering bringing Russia itself into NATO.
Yeah, but I think that's just talk. I think that's public relations
do
talk.
You?
I think it's absolutely that,
so,
in order to
okay.
make everyone think that, hey, we're trying to be nice to Russia, but they're not reciprocating.
Obviously, America and the military-industrial complex, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, all of them, Boeing, etc., are surrounding China and Russia with military bases, with missile defense systems. Why are they doing that? It's openly provocative, like South Korea today is shooting missiles and weapons into North Korea, openly provoking them. Is it so that we can set up a war somewhere and that'll be legitimized more and more and more and more, spending of America's tax dollars not on their healthcare or education, but on killing? Is that right?
I think that's a key element to it. But let me tell you a story that I think will answer this question
and
give you some sense. A couple years ago, during the Bush administration, towards the end of it, I was watching C-SPAN one evening, the government channel where we watch Congress and everything.
Yeah.
And they showed this speech in a huge auditorium full of military brass and CIA people. And the speaker was Thomas Barnett, who was introduced to the crowd as Donald Rumsfeld's strategy guy.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, he was a instructor at the Naval War College. He's gone on to write books. Now he's a consultant. They call him a futurist. But basically, he's a military strategist. And his job that night, they said, was to essentially inculcate the highest levels of the military with the new direction. And in his three-hour speech that I took copious notes and ordered the video because I said nobody will ever believe me when I tell them about this. In his three-hour speech, Barnett basically said this: under corporate globalization of the world economy, every country will have a different job. In America, he said, we're not going to make things anymore. Build cars, we're not going to make shoes, we're not going to make clothes, we're not going to build refrigerators, TVs, because it's cheaper to go overseas. Our role in America, he said, will be security export. And so it's no coincidence that today the number one industrial export product of America is
weapons.
What? And when weapons are your number one industrial export product, what is your global marketing strategy for that product line?
To create more wars.
That's right. And so today, it's no coincidence that last year at Sears, a friend and I went in there and took a look around, and we saw that they had a new children's clothing line of military uniforms.
Oh, no.
And so they're preparing the young people of America for this job of endless war.
Of blowing up the world.
Economic draft. To bring the world under control to the benefit of corporate globalization, for resource extraction, as oil and water become diminishing and other resources become in short supply around the world. This, they say, will be America's role, endless war.
This is called evil. There's only
it's
one
called
word, evil.
Evil. It is. And Mr. Barnett went on to say that there are parts of the world today that are not submitting to the authority of corporate globalization. And
how
our
dare
job
they?
will be to go in there and secure them and control them. And he laid it out. He said he had a big map, and he's written a book called The Pentagon's New Map, where he spells all this out. And it's Central Asia, where, of course, we are in Afghanistan today. It's the Middle East, where, of course, we are in Iraq today. It's Africa, where he said we'll be fighting 20 years from now for their oil. And then it's parts of Latin America, places like Venezuela, obviously, where Hugo Chavez isn't doing what the oil majors are telling him to do. And so Barnett laid out that we would be going into these countries with Leviathan.
What's Leviathan?
He said because of space technology, all warfare on the Earth today is net-centric. It's coordinated and directed by satellites, as you know.
Mm.
When the U.S. launched Shock and Awe in 2003, In the initial attack, 70% of the weapons were guided to their targets by space technology. So he said the old distinction between Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines is gone. He said there's going to be two services in the future, Leviathan and Systems Administration. Leviathan, he said, will go in with the overpowering shock and awe. We can take anybody out anywhere in the world at any time. He said the problem we have, the problem we're having today in Iraq, the problem we're having today in Afghanistan, is Systems Administration. After we take them over, then we got to run the place. And he said we're not doing a good enough job with that. And so today, Lockheed Martin, for example, is getting hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts from the Pentagon to train generations of systems administrators. And Barnett said these troops will never come home.
What does that mean?
That means they will go into Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan, and they will take over, essentially run the puppet governments, and they will never come home. Military rule, yes. And
Bruce.
So this is the prescription for our future. Now, there is always an Achilles heel, Helen. Every giant has an Achilles heel. And the Achilles heel, in this case, of this American empire is money. And so that's why they're going after Social Security. That's why they're going after Medicare and Medicaid. That's why they're going after defunding social progress. But
wait a minute. What they want to take the money away from Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, what, to build more weapons? What is
it? Oh, yeah. Space News.
But
again,
they've got enough money.
No, they don't. No, they've said that Star Wars will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth. And in an editorial in Space News several years ago, they said, you know, we've got to be good corporate stewards. We've got to come up with a funding source for our programs, and we don't have one at this time. And they said, we're now sending our lobbyists to Washington to secure it. It's the entitlement programs, they said, which officially in America today are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what's left of the welfare program after Bill Clinton got finished with it. So these are the programs that the aerospace, the weapons corporations have identified for defunding in order to move the money into endless war.
They've actually stated that, have they?
Yeah, in an editorial.
You've got to get to the biggest possible audience, Bruce.
I've made videos about this.
I
talk about it everywhere I go.
But you've got a limited audience. You've got to get to the mainstream, Bruce.
Well, I'm on your show right now. What more could I ask for?
Well, it's not mainstream, love. Would you write some blogs for our website, nuclearfreeplanet.org? Would you do that?
You guys could go to my blog anytime and lift anything off there.
Well, how do we get to your blog? What's the address?
It's called Organizing Notes. Just Google the words Organizing Notes, my name, and you'll go right to it. I do a blog every day. People are free to lift anything. You have my permission. Anyone listening right now, you have my permission to lift anything off my blog, Organizing Notes, anytime.
Well, you're one of the few people that I've found in my life that has a vision, who's prophetic, who is able to collate all this extraordinary, god-awful information into one sort of cohesive theme and to teach us. And for that, I thank you, Bruce Gagnon. You are the one that turned me on to the weaponization of space. I had no idea. And from that, I, with Craig Eisendrath, wrote a book called War in Heaven. People need to know what's going on, for God's sake, with their money. And
I want to tell you one more story, Helen, before we run out of time.
Okay.
In Bath,
yep.
There's Bath Iron Works that we talked about that is building these Aegis destroyers. And there's a worker there, a guy by the name of Peter Woodruff. He's worked there for 30 years. He came to me and he said, I want to start a petition amongst the workers to say we want to build wind turbines. Would you help me write it? Which I was happy to do. Then we took him to the local newspaper for a meeting with the editorial board. They saw how impressive he was. They asked him to write an op-ed. He did. Then the editorial writer wrote an editorial congratulating him as he was circulating this petition and getting hundreds and hundreds of workers at Bath Iron Works saying they wanted to build wind turbines. And then Peter came to me and said, I got permission to start a radio show, a weekly radio show at Bowdoin College in the nearby town. Would you come on the radio with me every week and play political music and talk about these things and do it together? And I said, absolutely. And so we've been doing that for 2 years. He's not yet been fired, we believe, because of the editorial that came out of the local newspaper. Mm. And he's created a remarkable discussion in our community about the need to convert the military-industrial complex. And just as it turns out, basically during the same period of time, the University of Massachusetts at Amherst Economics Department created a study looking at the employment effects of military spending. And they found, yes, it's true that if you spend $1 billion on military, you create 8,555 jobs. It's true. But they said, if you take that same $1 billion and you put it into healthcare, you create almost 13,000 jobs. You put it into building rail systems, mass transit systems, to get us out of our gas-guzzling cars to help solve for climate change, even if it certainly doesn't completely solve for climate change. It's a help. You create almost 20,000 jobs per $1 billion. So at a time when the American people are job scared and we're losing jobs, we're bleeding jobs as corporations are moving them overseas, the idea of converting the military-industrial complex is a job winner. So we've got to begin to talk to people and ask them this fundamental question. Which would you rather have from your tax dollars? For every $1 billion of your tax dollars, would you rather have 8,500 jobs building weapons for endless war? Or would you rather have almost 20,000 jobs building rail systems? And as we ask people that question, their eyes light up.
Yeah.
And you can imagine what they say.
Well, we've got a big job ahead of us, Bruce, and you're one of the leaders for sure, and anything I can do to help, I shall.
Plug my website, please, spaceforpeace.org.
Spaceforpeace.org.
And at the bottom of the website, on the homepage, is this study that I'm referring to. You can find it yourself.
From the University of Massachusetts.
That's right.
About job creation. Everyone, I tell everyone, I instruct everyone to go to Bruce's webpage, spaceforpeace.org. I want you all to go to that.
My blog is Organizing Notes.
Organizing Notes, the blog. And I want you all to become deeply involved in this issue. Your lives depend upon it, the lives of your children, and the future of America, let alone the world, depends upon it. So I thank you, Bruce Gagnon, once again, for a wonderful and inspiring interview, and no doubt in a year's time we'll be re-interviewing you.
I love you, Helen. You're wonderful.
Thanks, Bruce.
Bye-bye.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another inspiring, scary program.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.